for her, and she got to work with them on their case. Americans were supposed to have citizens' rights that made them impervious to the kind of discrimination that foreigners faced when moving into the city, but in practice, this could fail. Lots of people were simply without papers or any cloud documentation. It was hard to believe until you met them by the hundreds and eventually the thousands, day after day for years. The cloud's very bad day in the aftermath of the second pulse had wiped out millions of people's records, and no country had completely recovered from that except for Iceland, which had not believed in the cloud and kept paper records of everything. Today there was also going to be an influx of new refugees from New Amsterdam, the Dutch township. This floating city was one of the oldest of the townships, and like the rest of them, it floated slowly around the world, a detached piece of the Netherlands, which had been so flooded by the second pulse that New Amsterdam equaled something like 5% of the home country's remaining actual land. Like all the townships, it was essentially a floating island, mainly self-sufficient, and directed by Holland's government to wander the earth, helping intertidal peoples in whatever way possible, including relocating them to higher ground. Charlotte enjoyed visiting it when it jellyfished by New York, eddying outside the Verrazano Narrows in the big counterclockwise current that curled off the Gulf Stream. Townships couldn't come too close to the Narrows, because there was a danger of getting sucked in on an incoming tide and crashing into one shore or the other, or crashing into both and getting corked. But a flight out to them in a small plane often took less than half an hour in the air. So she took one of the flights from the Turtle Bay aircraft carrier and enjoyed the sudden view from the air. The city, the Narrows and its bridge, the open ocean. On the left, as they headed out to sea, she could see the drowned shallows of Coney Island, lined on its seaward edge by the barges that were dredging the sand of the old beach and moving it north to the new shoreline. Then over the blue plate of the ocean, and soon they descended to the startling green island floating ahead of them, a big island, big enough that its airport's landing strips could land jets. Not that there were many jets left. The city plane descended and rolled to a taxiing speed in about a third of the length of the runway. Once out of the plane and then the airport, they could have been on Long Island. There was no feeling of floating, no movement of any kind. This always amazed Charlotte. Around her, the neat little buildings made it look like a Dutch town. Despite the elegant look of the buildings and streets, it was not hard to see the uneasiness in the eyes of the people housed in the township's refugee dorms. It was a look Charlotte knew well, the look of her clients, here again staring at her. Needy looks, always trying to hook her into their stories, so that they were looks she had gotten good at deflecting. She couldn't feel their desperation too directly, or it would drive her mad. She had to keep a professional distance. And she could. But it took an effort. It was the thing that made her tired at the end of a day, or even an hour. Bone tired. And at some deep level, angry. Not at her clients, but at the system that made them so needy and so numerous. So New Amsterdam was now ferrying a contingent from Kingston, Jamaica. None of them had papers, and they looked Hispanic, not Jamaican, and spoke in Spanish among themselves, but Kingston was where New Amsterdam had picked them up. The Caribbean was like that. Charlotte sat down at a table with them and listened to their stories one by one, creating primary refugee documentation. That would insinuate them into the records, and eventually would serve adequately for them, even if they had no originary paper. It was as if she were plucking them out of the sea itself. "Don't forget to join the householders' union," she kept telling them. "That could be a big help." They were grateful for anything, and this, too, showed in their faces. And this, too, had to be ignored, as it was just another facet of their desperation. People didn't like to feel grateful because they didn't like the need to feel grateful. So it was not a good feeling, no matter which end of it you were on. One did good for others, not for the others' sake, nor for oneself, which would be a little sanctimonious at best. This seemed to suggest that there was no reason at all to do good, and yet it did feel like an imperative. She did it for some kind of abstract notion, perhaps, an idea that this was part of making their time the early days of a better world. Something like that, some crazy notion. She was crazy, she knew it. She was compensating probably for some lack or loss. She was finding a way to occupy her busy brain. It seemed like a right way to behave. It passed the time in a way more interesting than most ways she had tried. Something like that. But at the end of the day, even a day at sea, in the cool salt breeze and the sound of gulls crying, she was ready to pack it in. But she couldn't. Not at the end of this day. She needed to fly back and get out of her office and get home. No time to walk. She would need to get on the Vapo or even take a water taxi. Flying back in over the Brooklyn Shallows to the Turtle Bay aircraft carrier anchored next to the UN building, Charlotte sat at the left side window and marveled at the city in the late afternoon light. Sun blazed off canals and made the rank-and-file forest of buildings look like rows of standing stones in some half-sunk Avalon. Black pillars drowned to the knees. It was a surreal sight. There was no coming to terms with it. It never ceased to look bizarre, even though she had lived in it all her life. What a fate. A somewhat glorious fate, and despite all, she stared down at the city with a little sense of wonder, even pride. Down on the aircraft carrier, walk down the ramp onto the dock and shift in the mass of people, taking little steps, onto a crowded vaporetto headed into the canals of the city. Grumble from dock to dock, reading reports while the crowds surged off and on, off and on. She got off at the dock next to her office and went in, thinking she should have just gone home. Ramona and a group from the district's Democratic Party office met her as she was leaving and asked to walk her out. Charlotte shrugged, almost saying, "I gave at the office," but biting back the words. She didn't get why they were there. Out on the dock outside, they asked her if she would run for Congress, for the 12th district seat, which covered the drowned parts of Manhattan and Brooklyn and had been a controversial seat because of that, for many years representing more clams than people, and the people a bunch of squatters, communists, etc. "No way," Charlotte said, shocked. "What about the mayor's candidate?" Galina Esteban had anointed her assistant, Tanganyika John, to succeed the longtime congressman for the 12th, who was finally retiring. No one was very happy with this selection, but the party was a hierarchy. You started at the bottom and moved up one step at a time, school board, city council, state assembly. And then, if you had demonstrated lockstep team loyalty, the powers at the top would give you the party endorsement and its aid, and you were good to go. Had been that way for centuries. Outsiders did pop up to express various dissatisfactions, and occasionally some of them even overthrew the order of things and got elected. But then they were ostracized forever by the party and could get nothing done. They just wasted their time and whatever little money could be dredged up to support such quixotic tilts. So, but these people asking her to run were from the party office. In fact, they were its central committee, which made it a little different. Maybe a lot different. Esteban herself had come in as an outsider, which probably explained it. Come in as a star and disrupt the hierarchy, then become a power and anoint your own assistant to an unrelated post that was even more not yours to call than your own. Not right. And Tanganyika John was a tool and a fool. Still, running against her would be a lost cause and a horrid waste of time. Charlotte indicated this as quickly and politely as she could, then jumped on the vaporetto that mercifully gurgled into the dock headed down park, just as Charlotte's interlocutors were waxing eloquent with desperate pleadings. "Think about it!" Ramona and the others begged loudly as the vapo surged off to its next stop, wringing their hands like starving mendicants. "I will," Charlotte lied cheerfully. It was annoying, but it pleased her, too, just to think that here was something dumb she would not have to do, something that could be avoided with a simple, no fucking way. The vapo took a left at 23rd and deposited her at the dock in front of the Flatiron, and from there she took the elevator up to the skywalk level and walked west to Chopstick 1, cursing it ritually as she crossed it from Skybridge in to Skybridge out, and then hurried over 23rd to home. She got to her room with just enough time to change shoes, chomp down an apple, wash her face, and get downstairs. She walked in as the board meeting was beginning. She sat down, feeling a little unsteady, as if she were still at sea or in the air. The other board members regarded her curiously, so it must have shown. But she said nothing, explained nothing, just started the meeting with a quick, "Okay, let's go." Item 3 came quick enough. "Okay, this offer on the building. What are we going to do?" She stared at the others, and Dana, also a lawyer, said, "We're obliged to answer them legally, and just as a matter of doing due diligence." "I know." Charlotte hated the phrase, doing due diligence, but this was not the time to mention that. "I do doo-doo on your dumb due diligence." "No." "So," Dana continued, "the covenant requires we put any ownership question to a vote of the membership." Charlotte said, "I know, but I'm wondering if this is an ownership question."
"What do you mean? They're offering to buy us out."
"What I'm saying is it a real offer? Or is it some kind of stalking horse that is being used to find out our valuation or something like that?"
"How would that matter?"
"Well, if it's just a test for a comparative valuation, we as a board could just turn it down outright, without putting it to a vote."
"Really?"
"What do you mean, really?"
"I mean, do you think we could determine it was a fake offer with enough certainty to bypass our obligation to put it to a membership vote?"
Charlotte thought it over.
While she did, Dana said, "It wouldn't really do to turn the offer down as a board and see if they came back again, because if they did, we would be retroactively out of compliance."
"Out of compliance with our co-op covenant or with city law?"
"I'm not sure, but maybe both."
"I'd like to know before we decide," Charlotte said. "Maybe we can hold off on this again, poke around a little, study it a little, before we act either way." By now she was frowning. She could feel her face bunched. She wanted to refuse the offer so much it hurt. Her guts twisted, and she could feel her temples begin to pound. But Dana was a good lawyer and a good person, and probably it was true that they had to conform to the guidelines, do everything legally, so that she didn't accidentally give the enemy here, whoever they were, a hand up in the game. So Dana had to be listened to. "Listen, can we table this for tonight? Do a little more research and then get back to it at our next meeting? Please?"
"I guess so," Dana said. "Maybe we do need to know more before we decide. Can we talk to the people making the offer, find out what they have in mind?"
"I don't know. Morningside won't tell us who it is. That's part of what I don't like about it.
I want to ask Morningside again to let us talk to the people making the offer.
Let's do that. And table it for now. I move we table it.
Second, Charlotte said. They passed the motion and moved on. So the next morning, Charlotte gritted her teeth and called her ex, Larry Jackman.
Hey, Charlotte, he said. What's up?
Are you going to be in New York anytime soon?
I'm here today. What's up?
I want to meet you for coffee and ask you some questions. This was something they had started doing a few years back, meeting from time to time for coffee, their chats usually having to do with city business or old acquaintances in trouble who needed help, neither of them favorite topics of Larry's, but he had always been agreeable, and after a while they had an established tradition of getting together. So after a short pause, he said,
Always. Sounds good. How about 4:20 at the Pavilion in Central Park?
This was one of their hangouts from the old days, so it was with a little lurch that Charlotte agreed. Then it stuck at the bottom of her mind all day, like a burr in her sock. And yet even so she got lost in work, and it was 4 before she noticed the time, and then she had to hurry.
No way to walk 12 blocks uptown at high tide, when the first 3 blocks of it would be under shallow water, so she stepped onto an airboat taxi that then skidded up 5th over shallows, breakers, and seaweedy street, until turning and letting passengers off at the high tide slide, a floating pier now grounded in the middle of the street, waiting for water. This quick, if expensive, run left her with just the 15-minute walk up into Central Park. She lumped along, wishing her hip didn't hurt, and that she had lost more weight than she had managed to. Walking was hard. And yet she needed to walk to compose her mind. She was never quite comfortable meeting with Larry. There was too much history between them, and much of that history was bad. But on the other hand, some of it, a lot of it, was good, even very good, if you could drill down to those layers of the past under the bad years. When they were young law students, in love, almost all of it had been good. Then came the years when they were married, and good and bad were so closely mixed that you couldn't differentiate them. They were just the mix of those years, glorious and painful, and ultimately, in retrospect, and even at the time, frustrating. For they had not been able to get along. They hadn't seen eye to eye. No one does, but they couldn't seem to agree on what they weren't agreeing on. They hadn't figured their relationship out. Not even close. And then the good and bad had de-stranded, separated out. And suddenly they could see that there was a lot more bad than good. Or so it had seemed to Charlotte. Larry had said he was fine with a little discord, that she was being too demanding. But whether that was true or not, ultimately, the whole thing had fallen apart. Neither of them had the feeling anymore. And by the time they separated, though there had been some very bitter, angry moments, it seemed that mostly they both felt a sense of exhaustion and relief. That whole sorry era over. New incarnations for both of them. Stay civil when they had to be in touch, which they didn't, not having kids. After some years, that had mellowed into a kind of rueful nostalgia. And later still, getting together over coffee satisfied a little itch of curiosity in Charlotte, an urge to see how Larry's story had continued, especially after he shifted into finance and rose in that world, and became, she assumed, both rich while working for Adirondack and powerful, being tapped to be chair of the Federal Reserve. At that point, her curiosity outweighed her uneasiness when they got together. Still, every time, as now, when the time came for them to meet, for him to be there in person across a table from her, she felt a qualm, a little twist of dread.
How would she look to him, working as she did in the depths of a bureaucracy so marginal it had been demoted to public-private NGO status, doing the legal equivalent of social work? She didn't like to be judged.
"You're looking great," he said as he sat down across from her.
"Thanks," she said. "Your job must make you good at lying."
"Ha-ha," he said, "good at telling the truth. Telling the truth without people freaking out."
"That's what I meant."
"Which people?
Who would freak out at the truth?"
"The market."
"The market is people?"
"Of course. And Congress, too. Congress is people, and they freak out."
"But they do that always, right? So if you're always freaked out, I don't know where you go from there."
"They find ways. They have hyper-freakouts. Sometimes they go around the bend and get completely calm. That's what I'm always hoping for. And sometimes it happens. There are some good people in both chambers, on both sides of the aisle. It takes some time to figure out who is which."
"What about the president?"
"She's good. Pretty calm all the time. Smart. Has assembled a good team."
"By definition, right?"
"Ha ha. Always good to get together with you and get cut down to size a little."
"That's just what I was thinking."
"Are you still a non-fat latte person?"
"Yes, I never change."
"Not what I was implying."
"Wasn't it?"
"Okay. I guess I feel like your coffee habits are pretty fixed. Maybe I'm wrong."
"These days, I like half and half in an American coffee with a shot of espresso in it."
"Whoa!"
"New theories, new stomach lining."
"Surgery?"
"Yeah. I had that band put in."
"Not really."
"No, I'm feeling okay there now. I'm not sure what happened. Maybe the meditation is kicking in."
"Medication?"
"Meditation. I told you last time or the time before."
"I forgot, sorry. What do you do?"
"It's a kind of mindfulness meditation. I lie there in the Towers Farm and look at Brooklyn and think about how many things there are that I can't do anything about. After a while, that becomes like the whole universe, and then I feel calmer."
"I think I would fall asleep."
"Usually I do, but that's good too."
"Still insomniac?"
"Now I think of it as spreading my sleep around. Sleep, meditation, wakefulness. It's all getting to be the same for me."
"Really?"
"No." He laughed politely. They sipped, looked around the park. It was the last part of autumn in New York. The leaves had all turned and many had fallen, but some oaks, sycamores, and tweaked elms planted a few decades before were paying off now with their last great globes of red or yellow. It was, as everyone said, one of the handsomest times of year in the city, the time of shortened afternoons and sudden chill, and a clear quality to the low light that made Manhattan like a dream city, stuffed with significance and drama. The only place to be. They had sat across from each other like this, here in various parts of Central Park and elsewhere in the city, for almost 30 years now. Like giants plunged through the years, yes. And even though she was a bureaucrat and he was the head of the Fed, she knew all of a sudden that he considered them equals. "So, is the president really calm, do you think?"
"I think so. I think she's in the strong line, you know, and as progressive as an American president can be."
"Which isn't very much."
"No, but it matters when they are. I think she's in the line of FDR and Johnson and Eisenhower."
"Those are all 20th century presidents. You might as well add Lincoln."
"Well, I would, maybe, if it ever came up. If some kind of push came to shove. She wants that kind of opportunity, I think."
"A civil war over slavery?"
"Well, whatever the current equivalent would be. I mean, we do have some giant problems, as you know. And inequality is one of them, as you also know.
So yeah, I think she would love to do something big.
Interesting. Charlotte thought that over. I guess if you are going to do something so stupid as to be president, you would want to go for something big.
I think so. The temptation is there. I mean, you wouldn't do it thinking, hey, now that I'm president, I'll play it safe, hope nothing happens. Would you?
I don't know, Charlotte confessed. It's way outside my thought zone.
You never meditate by thinking, what would I do as president?
No, definitely not. But you're working for her. You have to think about that. A lot of us think the head of the Fed is one of the crucial jobs. He looked surprised.
I'm glad to think you might be one of them.
How could I not? You know me.
Well, yes. Sort of.
I think you do. Say we were concerned with justice when we were young. I think that was true of us, don't you?
He nodded, watching her with a small smile.
His idealistic ex still at it. He sipped his coffee.
But then I got into finance.
But that was moving toward power, right? Toward economics, which is toward political economy, which is toward power, which is still, ultimately, working on justice.
Or can be. That's what I was thinking at the time, I guess.
And I always saw that. I always gave you credit for that. He smiled again.
Thank you.
People get into finance for different reasons. Some of them do it just to make money, I'm sure, but you were never like that.
No, maybe not.
I mean, now you're a federal employee, so you're making peanuts compared to what you could be.
True, but I don't have to worry about money anymore either. So I'm not sure if I get any credit for that. You could say that at a certain point, power is more interesting than money. Once you've got enough money. You see that all the time.
I know. But whatever, here you are, chair of the Fed. It's big.
It's interesting, I'll admit that. It's maybe too big. I feel like I should be able to do more than I find I can actually do. It's like the Fed kind of runs itself, or the market runs it, or the world, and I sit there thinking, do something, Larry. Change something. But what? Or how? It isn't obvious, that's for sure. For one thing, the rest of the board and the regional boards have a lot of clout. It's not a strongly executive system.
No?
Not as much as I'd like. I feel more advisory than anything else.
Charlotte thought about that. But advisory to the president and to Congress...
True.
And if push came to shove, you know, like in a financial crisis, then sometimes your advice is what everyone is going to do. He laughed.
Guess I'll just have to hope for a crisis.
Charlotte laughed, too. Suddenly they were having a little fun. Those seem to come along every decade or so, so you have to be ready.
I guess.
They talked about other things, such as old friends and acquaintances they had enjoyed in the years when they were a couple. Each had kept in touch with one or two, and they shared their news. That led, naturally, to Henry Vinson. Actually, not. It would never be quite natural for Charlotte to ask Larry about any of his acquaintances in finance, as she had never taken any interest in them. Nor had Larry been inclined to share details of his interactions with them. Most of that part of his life had happened after they broke up. So she had had to consider how best to bring it up. But now she saw the way, which was to make it about him and his possible conflicts of interest. Because then he would assume that she was just tweaking him with problems arising from his success. That would fit their usual pattern. "Do you ever end up regulating your old partners?" she asked. He did frown a little at this. It was so outside her usual realm of interest. But then he winced a little, as if becoming aware she was needling him again, as she had hoped he would conclude.
I'm not head of the SEC, he pointed out by way of a parry.
I know that. But the Fed sets the rates, and that determines a lot of everything else, right? So some of your old partners will be helped and others hurt by any decisions you make.
Of course, he said, it's the nature of the job. Basically, everyone I ever worked with is going to be impacted.
So, Henry Vincent, too?
Didn't you guys have a kind of rocky breakup?
Not really.
Now he was regarding her with some suspicion. He had left Adirondack after Vincent had been made CEO by its board of directors. It had been in the nature of a contest or a competition, he had once admitted to her, in that the board of directors could have chosen either of them to be the next CEO, but they chose Vincent. Larry had still been the CFO, but there was not really room for the loser of such a selection process to stay in the company, especially since Larry didn't like many of the things Vincent was doing. He had therefore left and started his own hedge fund, done well, and then been appointed head of the Fed by their old law school classmate, now president. Vincent had also done well at Adirondack, and then with his own fund, Alban Albany, after he too had gone out on his own. So it could be regarded as a case of no harm, no foul, or two winners. Just one of those things. As Larry was explaining again now.
Still, it must be fun to tell him what to do.
Larry laughed.
Actually, he tells me what to do.
Really?
But of course, repeatedly, all the time. He wants rates this way, he wants them that way.
Isn't that illegal?
He can talk to me, anyone can. He's free to talk to me, and I'm free to ignore him.
So, nothing's changed. He laughed again.
True.
So, is that how it works, with you now in government regulating them?
It's just me in a different job. I don't stay in touch, but no one ever does.
So it's not the fox guarding the henhouse?
No, I hope not.
He frowned at this idea.
I think what everyone likes is for the Fed and Treasury to be staffed by people who know the ropes and speak the language. It helps just in being able to communicate.
But it's not just a language. It's a worldview.
I suppose.
So you don't automatically support the banks over the people, if push ever comes to shove?
I hope not. I support the Federal Reserve.
Charlotte nodded, trying to look like she believed it, or that he hadn't just answered her question by saying he would support the banks. The late afternoon light was bronzing the air of the park, giving all the autumn leaves and the air itself a yellowy luster. The ground was now in shadow. It was crisp, but not cold.
"Want to walk around a bit?" he asked.
"Sure," she said, and got up. She would be able to show that she had become a stronger walker, assuming he had ever noticed she had been having trouble with that, as probably he hadn't. She pondered how to bring up Vincent again. Once they got up and going, headed north up the west side, she said, "It's an odd little thing, but a cousin of Henry Vincent's was living in my building as a temporary guest, and then he went missing. We have the police looking into it, and they were the ones who found this relationship to Vincent."
Cousin?
Family relationship? Child of a parent's sibling?
He tried to shove her, and she dodged it.
"It's just one of the things they've been finding out," she added.
"That is odd. I don't know what to say."
"I only mention it because we were talking about the old days, and that made me think of Vincent and how I had heard about him in this other connection."
"I see."
Larry being Larry, he managed to make that sound like he saw more than Charlotte would like. They had fought a lot back in the day. She was remembering that now. That stuff had happened. That was why they had divorced. The good times before that were hard to remember, but not that hard. As they walked around the park paths, she found their past was very present to her mind.
all of it. She often imagined the past as an archaeological dig, with later events overlying and crushing the earlier ones. But in fact, it wasn't like that. Really, every moment of her past was present to her all at once, as in the dioramas at the Museum of Natural History. So the good times stood right next to the bad times, alternating panel by panel, room by room, making for a garbled, queasy stew of feelings. The past. The upper halves of the superscrapers ringing the north end of the park caught the last of the day's sunlight. Some windows facing southwest blinked gold, inlaid in immense glass curves of plum, cobalt, bronze, mallard green. The park's advocates had had to fight ferociously to keep the park free of buildings. As dry land, it was now 10 times more valuable than it had been before. But it would take more than drowning Lower Manhattan to make New Yorkers give up on Central Park. They had made one concession by filling in Onassis Pond, feeling that there was enough water in the city without it. But other than that, here it was, forested, autumnal, same as always, lying as if at the bottom of a steep-walled, open-roofed, rectangular room. It looked like they were ants. Charlotte said something to this effect, and Larry shook his head and chuckled at her. "There you go again, always thinking we are so small," he said. "I do not. I don't know what you mean." "Ah, well," he waved it aside. "It wasn't worth trying to explain," the gesture said. "Would only cause her to protest more, protest something obvious about herself. He didn't want to get into it." Annoyed, Charlotte said nothing. Suddenly, the persistent sense of being ever so slightly condescended to coalesced in her. He was indulging her. He was a busy, important man, making time for an old flame. A form of nostalgia for him. This was what lay there under the surface of his easy tolerance. "We should do this more often," Charlotte lied.
"For sure," Larry lied back.
To some natures, this stimulant of life in a great city becomes a thing as binding and necessary as opium is to one addicted to the habit. It becomes their breath of life. They cannot exist outside of it. Rather than be deprived of it, they are content to suffer hunger, want, pain, and misery. They wouldn't exchange even a ragged and wretched condition among the great crowd for any degree of comfort away from it. Tom Johnson. Damon Runyon's ashes were cast by Eddie Rickenbacker from a plane flying over Times Square.
C. Vlade. Vlade now made a kind of cops round of the building every evening after dinner, checking all the security systems and visiting all the rooms lower than the high tide line. Also the top floors under the blimp mast, and while he was at it, anywhere he thought taking a look would be a good idea. Yes, he was nervous, he had to admit it, to himself, if no one else. Something was going on, and with that offer on the building looking like a hostile takeover, the attacks might be pressure to accept. It wouldn't be the first time in New York real estate, nor the 1,000th. So he was nervous, and made his rounds with a pistol in a shoulder holster under his jacket. That felt a little extreme, but he did it anyway. A couple of nights after they had pulled Roberto out of the South Bronx, at the end of his tour of the building, Vlade got off the elevator at the farm and went out to the southeast corner to see how the old man was doing. No surprise to look in through the hotel's flap door and find Stefan and Roberto there with him, seated on the floor around a pile of old maps. "Come in," Hexter said, and gestured to a chair. Vlade sat. "Looks like the boys got some of your maps back." "Yes, all the important ones," the old man said. "I'm so relieved. Look, here's a Reese map, 1900. It won a prize at the World's Fair in France. Rhys was a French immigrant, and he took his map back to Paris, and it was the sensation of the fair. People lined up to walk around it. It was 10 feet on a side. The original was lost, but they made this smaller version to sell. It's a kind of celebration of the five boroughs coming together. That happened in 1898, and then they commissioned Rhys to do this. I love this map. Beautiful, Vlade commented. It had been much folded, but it did capture something of the gnarly density, the complexity, the sense of human depth crusting the bay, the man-hours that had gone into building it. Then here's the Bowlman map. Isn't this a beauty? All the buildings? Wow, Vlade said. It was a bird's-eye view of Midtown, with each building drawn individually. Oh, no. He cuts it off right at Madison Square. See, there's the edge of the Flatiron, but our building is cut off. Not the very top of it, see? Right next to the letter G in the index grid, I think that's the top of it. You can see the shape. Vlade laughed. The map didn't go any farther? I guess it was just a Midtown map. Anyway, this is all I've got. What's this colored one? Colored, indeed. It's the Lusk Committee map, the so-called Red Scare map. Ethnic groups, see, where they lived, which was where all the horrible revolutionaries were supposed to come from. What year was this? 1919. Vlade looked for their neighborhood. I see we had, what is this color? Syrians, Turks, Armenians, and Greeks? I didn't know that. Some neighborhoods are still the same, but most have changed. That's for sure. I wonder if you could do anything like this now. I guess you could, using the census, maybe, but I think it would mostly be a hodgepodge. I'm not sure, Vlade said. I'd like to see. Meanwhile, these are great. Thanks. I'm so happy to have them back. Vlade nodded. Good. So, look, that brings me to the little incident with the boys up in the Bronx. Why don't you tell me about that, too? Do you have a map that shows where the HMS Hussar went down? Hexter glanced quickly at the boys.
We had to tell him, Roberto said. He pulled me out.
The old man sighed. There's not one map, he told Vlade. There are maps of the time that helped me. The British headquarters map is an incredible thing. The British held Manhattan through the Revolutionary War, and their ordnance people were the best cartographers on Earth at that time. They made the map for military purposes, but also just to pass the time, it looks like. It goes right down to individual boulders. The original is in London, but I copied it from a photo when I was a kid.
Show him that one, Mr. H.
Okay, let's. The boys got out a large folder, like an artist's folder, and pulled out a big square mass of paper, treating it like nitroglycerin. On the floor, they unfolded two sheets of paper that together were about 10 feet by 5. And there was Manhattan Island, in some pre-lapsarian state of undress, a little cross-hatching of village at the Battery, the rest of it a wilderness of hills and meadows, forests and swamps and creek beds, all drawn as if seen from above. Holy God, Vlade said. He sat down beside it and traced it with a finger. The area Madison Square now occupied was marked as a swamp with a creek running east from it, debouching into an inlet on the East River. It's so beautiful. It is, Hexter said, smiling a little. I made this copy when I was 12.
I want to make a map like this for what's here now, Roberto declared.
A big task, Hexter noted, but a good idea. Okay, Vlade said. I love this thing, but back to the Hussar, please. Hexter nodded. So, this map was finished the very year the Hussar went down. It doesn't include the Bronx, but it does have part of Hell Gate,
And luckily, there's another great map that has the whole harbor, the final commissioner's plan of 1821. I've got a reproduction of it, too, see? Look at this. He unfolded yet another map. Beautiful, huh?
Very nice, Vlade said. Not quite the headquarters map, but excellent detail.
I like the way the water has waves in it, Stefan said.
Me too, said the old man. And look, it shows where the shore was when the Hussar sank. It was different then. These islands north of Hellgate were infilled to make Ward Island, and now it's entirely underwater. But back then there was a little Hellgate and a Bronx Creek, and this little island called Sunken Meadow was a tidal island. They marked all the marshes really well on this map, I think because they couldn't build on them or even fill them in, not easily anyway. So look, the Hussar hits Pot Rock over here on the Brooklyn side, and the captain tries to get to Stony Point near the south end of the Bronx where there was a pier. But all the contemporary accounts say the ship didn't make it and sank with its masts still sticking up out of the water. Some accounts have people even wading to shore. That wouldn't be true right off Stony Point because the tides run hard between there and the Brothers Islands and the channel is deep. Also, there just wasn't time to get that far. The accounts have it going down in less than an hour. The flood tide current runs at about 7 miles an hour here, so even if it was the fastest tide possible, they couldn't have gotten as far as North Brothers Island, which is where Simon Lake was diving back in the 1930s. So I think the ship sank between these little rocks here, between Sunken Meadow Island and Stony Point, where it was all landfilled later. So the whole time since it sank, people have been looking in the wrong place. Except right at the start, when the ship's masts were sticking out of the water. The Brits got cables under it in the 1820s, which is why everyone is pretty sure the gold was on board, or else they wouldn't have bothered with it. The fact that they were allowed to dive the site so soon after the War of 1812 boggles my mind. But anyway, I found their account of the attempt in London's Naval Archives, back when I was young, and they confirmed what I was thinking from the timing calculations. It sank right here. And he put his forefinger on the 1821 map, on an X he had penciled there. So how come the Brits didn't recover the gold? Vlade asked.
The ship broke apart as they were pulling it up, and then they didn't have the diving skills to get something as small as 2 wooden chests. That river is dark, and the currents are fast.
Vlade nodded. I spent 10 years in it, he said.
He waggled his eyebrows at the boys, who were looking at him amazed.
10 years as a city diver, boys, he said. That's why I knew what you were up to.
He looked at Hexter.
So you told the boys about this?
I did, but I didn't think they should do the diving. In fact, I told them not to.
The boys were suddenly very interested in the 1821 map.
Boys, Vlade said.
Well, Roberto said, it was just a case of one thing leading to another, really. We had this great metal detector from a guy who died, so we thought we'd just go up there and look around with that, you know?
Stefan said, we took it to the bottom where Mr. Hexter had said the Hussar was and got a ping.
It was great, Roberto said.
Where'd you get the diving bell? Vlade asked.
We made it, Roberto said. It's the top of a barge's grain hopper, Stefan explained. We looked at the diving bells at the dive shop at the Skyline Marina, and they looked just like the plastic tops of the grain hoppers. We glued some barrel hoops around the bottom edge of it to weight it down more, although it was already heavy, and glued an eye to the top, and there it was.
Vlade and Hexter gave each other a look.
You got to watch out for these guys, Vlade said.
I know. So the diving bell worked fine, and there we were getting a big hit on the metal detector, and this metal detector can tell what kind of metal it is, so it isn't just some boiler or something down there, it's gold. Or some other metal heavier than iron, The metal detector said gold, and it was in the right spot. So we thought we could make several dives and dig through the asphalt there. It was really soft, and maybe we could get down to it. We were going to show Mr. Hexter what we had found, and we figured he would be happy, and we could go from there.
This was beginning to sound a little altruistical to Vlade. He gave the two boys a stern look. It wasn't going to work, boys. Just from what I've heard here, the ship was on the bottom of the river. So say it's 20 feet down, which is what you'd need to get the ship itself underwater. Then they fill in that part of the river, covering the wreck. That shore was then about 10 feet above high tide. So what you've got now is about 30 or 40 feet of landfill over your ship. No way were you going to shovel your way down 30 feet under a diving bell.
That's what I said, Stefan said.
I think we could have, Roberto insisted. It's just a matter of spreading the digging out over lots of dives. The ground under the asphalt has to be soft. I was making huge progress.
The others stared at him. Really? Vlade asked.
Really? I swear to God.
Vlade looked at Hexter, who shrugged.
They showed me the metal detector reading, Hexter said. If it was accurate, it was a big signal and set for gold, so I can see why they wanted to try.
Vlade sat looking at the map from 1821. Bronx, yellow, Queens, blue, Manhattan, red, Brooklyn, a yellowy orange. In 1821, there was no Madison Square yet, but Broadway crossed Park Avenue there already, and the creek and swamp were drained and gone. Some kind of parade ground was marked at the intersection, and a fort. The Met was still 90 years in the future. The great city, morphing through time. Astounding, really, that they had drawn this vision of it in 1821, when the existing city was almost entirely below Wall Street. Visionary cartography. It was more a plan than a map. People saw what they wanted to see. As here with the boys.
Tell you what, he said. If you agree, I could go talk to my old friend Idelba about this.
He paused for a second or two, frightened at what he was proposing. He hadn't seen her in 16 years.
She runs a dredging barge out at Coney Island. They're sucking the old beach's sand off the bottom and moving it inland. She's got some wicked underwater power there. I might be able to talk her into helping us out. I think we'd have to tell her the story to get her to agree to it, but I would trust her to keep it to herself. We went through some stuff that makes me sure we can trust her.
That was one way of putting it.
Then we could see if you've got anything down there without you drowning yourselves. What do you say?
The boys and the old man looked at each other for a while, and then Roberto said,
Okay, sure. Let's try it.
Vlade decided to take the boys out to Coney Island on his own boat, even though the building's boat was a bit faster, because he didn't want this trip on the books. His boat, an 18-foot aluminum-hulled runabout with an electric overboard, had become somewhat of an afterthought for him, because he was always either in the Met or out doing Met business in the Met boat, but it was still there, tucked in the rafters of the boathouse. And once he got it down, it was a pleasure to see it again and feel it under the tiller as they hummed out 23rd to the East River and headed south across Upper New York Bay. Once they were clear of the traffic channels, he opened it up full throttle. The two wings of spray the boat threw to the side were modest, but the frills topping them were sparked with rainbow dots, and the mild bounce over the harbor chop gave them an extra sense of speed. Speedboat on the water. It was a very particular feel, and judging by the looks on the boys' faces, they hadn't often felt it. And as always, passing through the Narrows was a thrill. Even with sea level 50 feet higher, the Verrazano Bridge still crossed the air so far above them that it was like something left over from Atlantis. It couldn't help but make you think about the rest of the world. Vlade knew that world was out there,
but he never went inland. He had never been more than 5 miles from the ocean in his life. To him, this bay was everything, and the giant vestiges of the antediluvian world seemed magical, as from an age of gold. After that, out to sea, the blue Atlantic. Swells rocked the boat, and Vlade had to slow down as he turned left to hug the shore, now marked by a white line of crashing breakers. For a half hour they ran southeast, just offshore, until they passed Bath Beach, where Vlade headed the boat straight south to Seagate, the western end of Coney Island. Then they were off Coney Island, really just a hammerhead peninsula at the south end of Brooklyn, a reef now studded with ruins. They paralleled the old shore, humming east slowly, rocking on the incoming swells. Vlade wondered if the boys might be susceptible to seasickness, but they stood in the cockpit, staring around, oblivious to the rocking, which Vlade himself found rather queasy-making. Tideline ruins on Coney Island stuck out of the white jumble of broken waves, various stubs and blocks of wrecked buildings. They looked like gigantic pallets that had grounded here. One could watch a wave break against the first line of apartments and rooftops, then wash through them north into the scattered rooftops behind, breaking up and losing force, until some backwash slugged into the oncoming wave and turned it into a melee of loose white water a couple hundred yards broad and extending for as far as they could see to the east. From here, the coastline looked endless, though Vlade knew for a fact that Coney Island was only about 4 miles long. But far to the southeast, one could see the white water at Breezy Point, marking the horizon and thus seeming many miles distant. It was an illusion, but it still looked immense, as if it would take all day to motor to Breezy Point, as if they were coasting a vast land on a bigger planet. Ultimately, Vlade thought, you had to accept that the illusion was basically true. The world was huge. So maybe they were seeing it right after all. The boys' faces were round-eyed, awestruck. Vlade laughed to see them.
Great to be out here, right?
They nodded.
You ever been out here before?
They shook their heads.
And I thought I was local, Vlade said. Well, good. Here, see that barge and tug about halfway down Coney Island? That's where we're going. That's my friend Idelba doing her job.
Is she about halfway done with it? Roberto asked.
Good question. You'll have to ask her.
Vlade approached the barge. It was tall and long, accompanied by a tug that looked small in comparison, though the tug dwarfed Vlade's boat as they drew alongside. There was a dock tied to the barge that Vlade could draw up to, and a crew of dockmen to grab their painter and tie them fast to dock cleats. Vlade had called ahead, feeling more nervous than he had felt for many years, and sure enough, there was Idelba now, standing at the back of the group. She was a tall, dark woman, Moroccan by birth, still rangy, still beautiful in a harsh, frightening way. Vlade's ex-wife, and the one person from his past he still thought about, the only one still alive, anyway. The wildest, the smartest, the one he had loved and lost, his partner in disaster and death, his comrade in a nightmare for two. Nostalgia, the pain of the lost home, and the pain of what had happened. Idelba led them up a metal staircase to a gap in the taffrail of the barge. From the top of the stairs, they could look down into the hull of the barge and see that it was about a third full with a load of wet, blonde sand, a little mottled with seaweed and gray mud. Mostly, it was pure wet sand. A giant tube, like a firefighter's hose, but 10 times bigger around and reinforced by internal hoops, was suspended from a crane at the far end of the barge over the open hull,
and newly dredged sand, looking like wet cement, was pouring out of it into the barge. A big, dull, grinding roar, mixed with a high whine, came from the innards of the barge.
"We're still dredging pure sand,"